From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today on the show, how and where we spend our lives has shifted radically during the pandemic.
Instead of just reverting to what we've been used to doing, there could be an opportunity to see things differently. And I think transportation is part of that.
We'll talk to two urban planners about how cities can hold on to the lessons that they've learned during the pandemic. And a conversation with acclaimed Detroit documentary filmmaker Dream Hampton. Her 2019 docuseries, Surviving R. Kelly, launched a national reckoning on the R&B star's long history of abusive behavior. We'll be talking to her about the role art has to play in the fight for social justice.
As you build an institution in Detroit, which MoCat is certainly going to be, how can you be accountable to community?
Those conversations coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Later on the show, we'll talk to filmmaker Dream Hampton about the intersection of the arts and activism.
I grew up going to the DIA, and it's where I discovered a love first for Diego Rivera and then for just art.
That's later on the show. But first, the year of pandemic was illuminating for a lot of us as individuals and communities about what works and what doesn't work in our systems. And we saw the human emotional forces that at times usurped the pragmatic, like folks gathering with friends and family to share a meal, even when the threat of also sharing a virus loomed over the occasion. We saw outdoor dining bubbles pop up outside of restaurants and lean-to sheds with propane heaters along city streets. We saw whole blocks of downtown corridors cordoned off to give people more space rather than cars. Cars themselves took on a different role in our lives. They were the opportunity to take a drive and get out of the house. But we were also in our cars far less often. And we saw neighbors more often, taking walks or playing outside. Everything about the way that we lived in the spaces around us shifted. But will any of those changes stick once we've reached herd immunity, whenever that may be? Here to look at the big picture of how spaces are designed and could be reimagined for a changed world is Robin Boyle, Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at Wayne State University. Hi, Robin.
Yes. Hi there.
And also with us is Olga Stella. She's Executive Director of Design Core Detroit at the College for Creative Studies. Hi, Olga.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you guys both for joining. And I wanted to start out by asking you both, what have you noticed that has been different about the way that you use the spaces around you and what you've been drawn to over the past year? Robin, can we start with you?
Yes. Well, I am in the somewhat fortunate position that now being retired from Wayne State University, it's given me an opportunity to use my day differently. And during the shutdown and throughout the COVID period, I think walking, consistently going outside to get exercise, looking at the place that I thought I knew but really didn't know it as well as I've begun to learn it over the past, what, we're at 12, 13 months of this now. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think a lot more about some of the small-scale issues, small-scale features, small-scale images that you see when you're out walking in neighborhoods, learning new routes, looking at different places. I think that has really been a change in my life at this stage.
Olga, how about you? Was there anything that surprised you about how the pandemic affected how you think or use your spaces?
Well, having my own office space became a really important priority, given that we had two children that were doing virtual school and have been doing virtual school for a year now. And I hadn't previously had an office space in our home because I loved going to the office every single day and working there. And then the other piece, too, has been just the internet connectivity. I mean, I live in a neighborhood that is relatively close to downtown, and you would think that our internet would be amazing, but just like many other families, you know, we've really suffered around bandwidth when you have four people all on Zoom all day long. Mm-hmm. And we've obviously had to make adjustments as a result.
Robin, I'd like to talk As we dive into some detail about cities and spaces, last year we saw a dramatic reduction in car travel and global CO2 emissions. Meanwhile, we saw spikes in bicycle sales. People just weren't commuting long distances to work anymore, as Olga said, and we've been this car culture for so long in this state. Do you think the pandemic could change the role of the automobile in our lives and also in city planning?
I think it might. There could be, quote, a return to normal, but there is an opportunity for more of a change. There is a chance that instead of just reverting to what we've been used to doing, there could be an opportunity to see things differently. And I think transportation is part of that. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, the auto dependency which we have here is going to immediately change because of what we've had with COVID. But I think people might be starting to realize there's a different way of living, that it's not always requiring us to jump into our car. Now, of course, that has implications for access. And if you live in a place where you have got the opportunity to walk or cycle or use some form of community transportation to get to the services and facilities you need, that's great. Now, if you don't live in one of these areas, then we're back to the same problem. So really, the transportation issue is driven, I think, by location and access and availability. And that's a heavy lift. We're going to have to think carefully. In fact, August's comment there about how she's able or not to get onto the internet is part and parcel of what I think people are actually talking about. How do we actually work and connect? Which means thinking about a different form of infrastructure. It's not just about widening the roads. It's not just about getting more speed on the roads, more cars available on the road. But perhaps it is a combination of activities which include a different way of moving around, a different way of working, and a different way of thinking about our community.
Olga, we saw some downtown areas close off streets to make them more pedestrian friendly. Are these good or practical changes for cities to make going forward, or are we sort of permanently wed to this grid of streets for cars?
No, I think there's absolutely an opportunity to create more public spaces and more public gathering spaces, as we go forward, because I do think there's going to be lasting kind of public health implications, even when the worst of the pandemic is over and we have, hopefully herd immunity. People are going to be considering, kind of density and wanting more of that kind of public space and wanting to be outside and thinking about, the transmission of germs. So I do think that those kinds of changes will happen. I think it's going to be important, though, for us to be thoughtful about where they happen and how they happen in a way that really helps support the small businesses that are around them and how those small businesses are able to kind of make the best use of those public spaces so that they really feel intentional as they go forward and can maybe transition into more permanent spaces. And we have a great example in this actually in New York City when they started going on some of these road diets over the last, many years and really being thoughtful about how to give back some of that public space to small business owners to create those gathering spaces. So the template is there. I think what we're going to need, and hopefully with this the new stimulus money coming from the federal government, there'll be an opportunity to really test out and maybe make permanent some of these concepts, especially in places where they can support small business.
Can I just pick up on Olga's comment about health? Sure. I think she makes a really important point. And in many respects, we turned away from understanding that health is a very important part of how we live and how we organize community. 120 years ago, the whole project of building better places, urban planning, if you want to use that term, was grounded on a number of very important precepts that we got away from: air quality, access to daylight and sunlight, and also the provision of open space. If you look back to the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, there was a lot of conversation about how we need to have good open space where we can all recreate, we can go outside, we can have, quote, healthy living. We think the term healthy living is sort of a modern term, but it's not really. It takes us back to an understanding that access to good air quality and good water were absolutely fundamental. One lesson of COVID is that we need to be careful. We need to remember that we need to improve our infrastructure. We need to provide these services for us as society to live a healthier life. And gosh, we've got many examples around here in Southeast Michigan that we need to remember about.
Well, Robin, you know, early in the pandemic shutdown, there was this real quieting of our environments. Noise pollution specifically was dramatically reduced. And it was actually, I found, very pleasant. All of these creatures also came out from their wild spaces into cities. I remember seeing a picture of a coyote crossing the Golden Gate Bridge. And none of these changes were permanent. Already we've seen that. But it made city life lovely. How can cities harness some of that quietude when they're designed to be bustling?
It's a very good question. Yes, indeed. I mean, even where I am, there's been a lot of postings on the internet of turkeys. Mm-hmm. Turkeys appearing out of nowhere and wandering down the street. I think that the opportunities that we see going ahead can be shaped by what we've seen in our main street. The way in which many communities, not all, but many communities, I think Northville's a great example of how they did reconsider how that main street could operate. With less traffic, it is a quieter environment. It's a safer environment, bluntly, it is. And if we can retain some of that, bringing the street back to the people who want to walk and do things, whether it's for commerce or recreation or both, let's go in that direction and consider how the streets that we have, particularly in these clusters, in these more dense areas, can be more friendly to the pedestrian rather than giving over so much space to the car. Now, that's going to take a bit of a change from everybody. It's a learning exercise on all sides. Mm-hmm. If we want to get more walkability, denser downtowns, which many of us do, there has to be give and take on both sides. And we can't expect to be able to park right outside that the shop that we want to go and pick something up and rush home. We do need to respect that giving over our downtowns to the pedestrian means we might need to walk a bit further from our parked car. And that's not going to do any harm to our health.
In just a minute, we'll continue my conversation with Olga Stella and Robin Boyle about how the pandemic has changed our cities, sometimes for the better. This is Stateside. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. We're talking today about the ways in which the pandemic has forced us to rethink public spaces and how we move about within our communities. I'm joined by Robin Boyle, Professor of Emeritus of Urban Planning at Wayne State University, and Olga Stella. She's Executive Director of Design Corps Detroit and Vice President at the College for Creative Studies. Let's get back to that conversation. Olga, being outside and active outdoors was one of the few respites that we were all afforded for months on end. Even as restaurants began to reopen, they shifted much, if not all, of their business to being outdoors. Does indoor-outdoor design make sense also going forward?
Absolutely. I think small business owners are even more hyper aware of how volatile the business environment is. And I think for those that have the means to do so, and is even just a space to think about how to make some of these changes more permanent, you know, being able to keep that parking space in front of their business or the sidewalk in front of their business as an extension of their business, they're seeing what those benefits are today. And I think starting to consider what those benefits could be in the future. A great example of that is Avalon Bakery and their flagship store in Midtown Detroit. Through Design Corps, we've supported them with a Commerce Design Refresh grant to help really extend, take that outdoor patio space that they've used in the summertime and really create an outdoor extension of their business, because that is something that they see helping them, you know, be able to withstand not just the impacts of the pandemic now, but to be able to allow their business to grow. But really, the key is going to be about the resources that they need, access to designers, and then the capital. And for many of these businesses, just rebounding from the impacts of lost revenue, lost customers, finding those resources might be challenging. But I think if we can support them, we'll see far more resilient businesses into the future.
Robin, things like public parks and water features, whether it's rivers or fountains, are considered when cities think about the human desire to congregate. Do you think that the emphasis on that desire to gather will continue and be considered in urban design plans, even when we know now that pandemics aren't necessarily a once-in-a-lifetime deal, that we could see the spread of viruses really affect humanity if we are in large crowds of people?
That's a good point. That is a very good point. Density is a double-edged sword, because we came out of a period in the industrial city where density created problems, and we've moved away from it. And now, of course, we're wanting to come back and rediscover the benefits of density. So there is a tension there. There absolutely is. And it's a very good question, and one that I think we're going to grapple with. There's another issue that I think I just wanted to raise, and that is, while we are eager to have improved open spaces and walkability is very important, there's still a pushback. I mean, even I'm sitting here in Birmingham, Michigan, and we're in the middle of a master plan, and we're looking at alternatives of using, for example, the Rouge Corridor, which is a wonderful opportunity to walk through the city and connect to the north and also to the south. And yet we still get pushback. Some of the folks here saying, well, we don't want to improve access. Nature is what nature is, and we should let it be. And yet we know that access to walking in these areas does require intentional activity and improving the surfaces, being able to get those who are disabled, they're able to use these spaces. So I'm hoping that during this reconsideration of how we go forward, that we are open to the idea of letting everybody recreate, with that everybody can get access to these open spaces. And it allows them to be dense when they want, but also to spread out, to use our open spaces in a way that people want for themselves.
Olga, do you have hope that designers going into the future can really reimagine the world that we live in, that both embraces density and how cities are used, but also provides people with the health and wellness of space and environment and nature?
Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly what designers do. They're creative problem solvers and within, you know, the set of constraints. And I think the challenge is always going to be in what the client wants. And so I think it's important that we're having this discussion, because, you know, designers are designing within the parameters of what governments are asking, what businesses are asking. And this is an opportunity for all of us to think a little bit bigger and more expansively about what the future has to hold.
So I want to wrap up sort of where we started, but to phrase it, Robin, to revisit this idea of what we don't want to return to when we return to normal. You know, there's plenty of normal that we don't want to return to. So what sort of tops your list?
What would top my list is, I think, a realization that this pandemic has shown that we are all connected. And I think it's important that we should all understand that the walkability, the idea that we need to be outside, that we're exercising, that we're able to appreciate the outdoors, means that we have equitable provision of open space and equitable access. I mean, even the village of Franklin is tearing itself apart again over this conversation about whether to have sidewalks. To me, that's looking backwards. Shouldn't everybody be able to walk out of their house and find a reasonably safe sidewalk to be able to go for a walk? It sounds pretty basic. The doctors are telling us that the most important thing for all of us is to make sure that we exercise a little bit every day. And if that just means walking around the block, then so be it. But not everybody has that. And we should be thinking that as we go forward. So my motto for tomorrow is make sure everybody can get to a sidewalk and use it safely.
Olga, how about you? What normal don't you want to see come back?
I hope that we, well, maybe I'll spin it on the positive, which is I hope that we will continue to be really, really human-centered in our solutions as opposed to just defaulting to the way things were. And I, you know, that both is like thinking about, so what do our kids really need as we try to return back to normal? As we think about like all these different individual populations, whether they're our elders or our kids, you know, our neighbors, what do workers really need? Are we just asking people to come back to the office because it's what we've always done? Are we thinking about ways of working, ways of living, ways of playing that are even more beneficial to individuals? And that kind of human-centered approach is what I hope that we gravitate towards, as opposed to just defaulting to what we've known in the past and, you know, what is kind of easy for the masses. It's really time for us to tackle some of the challenges that have resulted from a one-size-fits-all approach to public policy, to development, to work. And I really hope that we have the kind of intestinal fortitude to do that as we go forward.
Olga Stella is Executive Director of Design Core Detroit, and Robin Boyle is Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at Wayne State University. Thank you guys both for joining us today. And here's to a more beautifully designed future.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you here also.
The social justice and Me Too movements of the past few years have called us all to rethink what's right in how we treat each other, and also what we're willing to forgive of past transgressions. It also brings to mind long-held questions over how and when to separate art from the troubled artist. The Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit has had a reckoning of its own in the past year, having ousted its director for a hostile and racist work atmosphere, a particularly confounding set of circumstances in a city that is about 80% Black. Now MOCAD is actively working to right past wrongs and reform its role within Detroit. The newest member of MOCAD's board is a woman who has a long legacy of working in the space between art and activism. Dream Hampton is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker, a journalist, and an activist. She was executive producer of Surviving R. Kelly, a highly acclaimed docu-series that looks at the years of abuse and manipulation women have suffered at the hands of R&B legend R. Kelly. Dream is also a native of Detroit. Dream Hampton, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So it occurred to me that your joining MOCAD makes perfect sense, as your career has been what seems to be this perfect symbiotic relationship between art and activism. Can you talk about how you've been able to strike the balance between those two and if ever one has been the leader over the other?
Yeah, I mean, great question, because the truth is there isn't really balance. They're two beyond full-time jobs. They take up, both of them, 200% of your time. And so there have been absolute gaps when I look at my life, and which is also my career. I don't know that there's a big distinction. I kind of do what I love, and therefore it's my life. And there are whole years when all I was doing, even recently, I was living in Los Angeles, splitting my time between Los Angeles and Detroit, and I found myself working on two different props, props 47 and 64. And they were my first time doing activism that was connected to actual legislation. One was about changing felonies to the misdemeanors that they should have always been, and the other one was about the legalization and the economic equity issues connected to the legalization of marijuana. And learned so much doing both of those legislations, but I wasn't at that same time also making art. It was when I told my partner in that work, hey, I'm so glad we got these two props passed. I need to go and do, you know, some film now, make some art. And then I went and made three film and TV projects, Surviving R. Kelly, one of them. So if I started working on those three films in 2018, I would say from 2014 to 2018, I was just working on legislation. So I don't have a balance. I kind of go in between. It's a toggle.
So the last time I saw you and I was interviewing you just about your career, in between moments while you were waiting for us to get set up and all of that, I remember you were on a activism call, and I was like, oh, how does this woman find the time for all this incredible stuff? But then, you know, it kind of reminds me of Denzel Washington. I once heard him say that he makes the equalizer so that he can make Fences, and that he kind of goes back and forth between the films he wants to make and the films that make him a lot of money so that he can make those films. I mean, when it comes to balance, do you have to kind of strike that balance of doing the things that are meaningful to you and make money, but that give you the space to work on things that don't pay the bills at all?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that I just do the work that's in front of me and hope that it pays the bills. And if it doesn't, then I just don't have cable. You know, like, I'm a working class girl from the east side of Detroit. So I probably don't need as much money as Denzel does, you know, to live. And I also have realized, just thinking how quickly time has passed, I realize how short life is. And so when you do something that has some success, like Surviving R. Kelly, and I did, again, three projects that year, two of which I'm very proud of, but hardly anyone saw. So you have this one project out of three that people saw, and it gets you all these meetings. I don't then look at these new opportunities as, you know, what's going to be my payday and what's going to be what I care about. Because I think that life is short, I'm only going to do the stuff that I care about. The three films that I did in 2018, one was shot in an Indiana prison, and the guys inside were the directors. It was called It's a Hard Truth, Ain't It? It was on HBO. The other was, you know, another six-part docuseries that was on BET called Finding Justice, and I cared deeply about all three of those projects, including Surviving R. Kelly, but only one of them had some kind of payday. And the payday wasn't financial. It was just that people saw it, and then there was impact. But I would say the other two had their own impact, too. So I don't know. My measurement for success is pretty, again, I don't know if it's tempered by my working class, like, roots, but I don't know. I've known people, weirdly, even though I'm from the east side of Detroit, I was really young when I started meeting millionaires and some of them who went on to be billionaires. And they're not, like, happier than me on my best days. So I don't connect that to wealth. I grew up in Detroit when, like, a lot of my friends were dealing drugs. They had a ton of money. So I've been in every fancy car you can be in. So I don't need a fancy car. I have a Volkswagen. I don't know. I'm okay.
So when we're talking about things that you make space and time for, regardless of the payday, when it comes to then MOCAD and taking this on, what are you hoping to bring to the board or to help shift at MOCAD?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was actually honored. I know this sounds like something that people say, but I was super honored to be invited. I love what they have been trying to do there. And for me, that reach can be just as important as whether or not they reach their goal, you know? I've seen them bring in amazing people as curators. One of the very first shows that I saw there, Visions in a Cornfield, blew my socks off. It's definitely one of the best shows I've seen in the past 10, 15 years. I remember them also making missteps from the beginning. Remember they had that sign? You were probably still at WDET and had to pass it every day that said, mm-hmm. Nothing is going to be all right or something.
It's like, it's all going to be all right or, yeah.
No, it was nothing is going to be all right.
Is that right?
It was the first sign. Yeah. And so Community was like, are you friggin' kidding me? We don't need your, like, dystopic irony or, like, you know, your Tim Burton vibes. So they changed it. They changed the sign. And I remember being, wow, they were actually responsive to Community. I'm not sure that would have happened in New York. New York would have just kept on being, you know, droll and ironic or whatever they were going for. And so, you know, that kind of responsiveness to Community, I'm not saying it's always been there. I'm not saying they've always met community demands. And I'm not saying that my joining the board is going to improve that, but it'll be one of the things as a board member that I'm looking at is how, as you build an institution in Detroit, which MOCAD is certainly going to be, how can you be accountable to community?
That's so interesting. My memory had skipped right over the nothing will be all right sign.
Do you remember it now?
Yes, because I just looked it up and I said yes, because they changed it. And you're absolutely right.
They changed it because people said, are you kidding me?
Right.
It was like 07 or 08. Things were like really, you know, it was, of course, we felt the first global crisis, financial crisis before the rest of the world did. And yeah, it just wasn't a message that people wanted to see every day. And they responded and changed it. I remember thinking, that's interesting.
What do you think is the art or artist or even institution's role in being responsive to the world around it and what the world demands of art?
Well, I mean, this is a question that is happening across the country and across the world. You have just all kinds of different groups that are popping up that are asking important questions of museums, because it turns out that more people visit museums than almost any other place in the country. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was surprising. It was way more than amusement parks, than sports stadiums, and it could be these mandatory trips that our kids go on, but it turns out, and it's true though for me too, when I travel the world, I go to a museum. I grew up going to the DIA. It's where I discovered a love first for Diego Rivera and then for just art in general. Learned different canons, and whether it's ancient or modern or postmodern. So I remember just being exposed as a teenager to everything that the DIA had to offer. In fact, I became a filmmaker from watching weird art films at the DFT, when I was in ninth grade. So I know how important these spaces are. And I just know that, yeah, there's a worldwide conversation. Some of it is about repatriating works that were pillaged during colonization and war. And these are ongoing questions. These aren't just ancient ones. Certainly you have places like Greece or Nigeria saying, hey, give us back our stuff. And then you have stories post-wars where you have, soldiers in Arkansas who stole some ancient Mesopotamian thing out of a rock. So there are interesting conversations that are happening around art, provenance, activism. They're all happening right now. And it's an interesting place to take a peek if you're interested at all.
We've got to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll continue my conversation with Detroit filmmaker Dream Hampton. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. I've been talking to Detroit filmmaker Dream Hampton about her work and the role arts play in advancing social justice. Hampton recently joined the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit. Now back to our conversation. Dream, you became a national name with your byline on some really big profiles of rappers in the mid-1990s, and you also counted some of hip-hop's biggest names as colleagues or friends at the time. People still call you one of the most important hip-hop journalists to put words to the genre, but it's not an accolade that I've known you to love, and I'm just interested in asking you about why this recognition lands with you in a funny or frustrating place.
Well, I don't know. I was in film school when I started writing. Some of it is that it's an over-description, right? I get described as the first woman editor of The Source. And while that's true, I was the photo editor and then the assistant editor. Kim Osorio was the first editor-in-chief, and that's probably what they mean. I was at The Source for 18 months when I was 19. I wrote for Vibe for another 10 years, but I don't think I ever went into their office. And I certainly wasn't as prolific. Those props can just go to someone else, is all I'm saying. there are people who actually care. I certainly have not hip hop right now, and not just right now. I've never listened to a whole Kanye West album. I'm sure they're good. I remember hearing pieces of 808 that were amazing.
Are you sure they were good?
I'm sure. I think maybe. I know that I don't think he can rap, but I didn't think Tupac could rap. And so, therefore, if you're hearing this and that's offensive to you, you can just say, well, she doesn't know anything about hip hop anyway. And you're right, I don't. So that settles that.
Well, I've been thinking about you a lot lately because I realized for myself that it's a lot harder for me to listen to hip hop and rap that I used to love because the messages are so dismissive of women. I find myself now searching for more empowered female MCs in a way that I never did maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Do you reflect differently on the art of people who you came up with, whose messages you don't always love?
Well, I mean, I'm proud to say that I handled it then. It's not an afterthought for me. I was self-identifying as a feminist by the time I started doing that work at 19. I'd already, begun reading bell hooks and been thinking about misogyny and art, and whether I'm looking at Picasso's work where he's literally rearranging women that he's also in real life terrorizing, or I'm looking at, I mean, treat her like a prostitute by Slick Rick, an MC that I love. Tribe Called Quest, their date rape song. I remember us taking on a Tribe Called Quest back in the day. I mean, the first thing I ever wrote at the Source, for instance, when I was 19, was an article about Dr. Dre physically assaulting Dee Barnes. And I had death threats from death row. So I think that, you know, one of the things that's been amazing about Me Too is to learn, you know, yes, like maybe this is starts with some Hollywood women sharing their stories, and maybe those Hollywood women are only B-list, and then the A-listers like Gwyneth and Angelina come out. And then immediately there was this pivot that I was grateful that Time's Up did, you know, to say janitors in California. And so what we learned from Me Too in those early days of the hashtag and people using that hashtag to nest their own testimonies around trauma and just everyday misogyny, casual or violent, all of it is violent, but casual or like super, you know, whatever the spectrum would be, we found that it's everywhere. You know, that is actually the story of Me Too. But what we learned early in Me Too is that we don't have to look at something as outrageous as hip hop or rock and roll. We could obviously do the same thing with music from any genre in the 80s and 90s. You could find misogyny. But we can look at it in every aspect of our life, which I knew then too. You know, I knew that the first time that I heard that women were bitches and hoes wasn't on a Snoop Dogg record, but it was in church, where I learned the binary of Madonna and the whore.
That's so interesting. So how do we determine what is a forgivable sin, maybe, of an artist versus a transgression that's so egregious that we have to, like, completely cleanse ourselves of the art as well? On that extreme, R. Kelly would be a pretty great example, although many people have not cleansed themselves of his art. How do you make that distinction?
Yeah, it's hard for me. I love R. Kelly's music, so I get it. I'm not here to be the referee around that. I included the women who began the Mute R. Kelly campaign in the documentary, but I didn't start the Mute R. Kelly campaign. I'd already failed back then that, you know, very young dream who was reading Pearl Clegg, of course, from Detroit, playwright and author. Her father was Reverend Clegg, who started the Shrine of the Black Madonna. And she wrote an incredible kind of chap-sized book called Mad at Miles. When Quincy Troops' Miles Davis autobiography came out, and he was gleefully or just completely unrepentantly talking about physically abusing women like Cicely Tyson. And what Pearl Clegg was calling for in the book Mad at Miles, it was about boycotting his music. And when you have someone like R. Kelly who, when you buy his concert ticket or when you are supporting his music with money, you are helping to tie women to radiators, then there's something that you can do about it, you know? I also think that there's, you know, Detroit has been leading in terms of social justice, leading practices around restorative justice and transformative justice. And I think those are important too, you know? I remember calling in Too Short instead of calling him out. He'd made some ridiculous video for some rap site about how to corner a girl on the playground and smooch her booty. It was like an instruction video for eighth grade boys on how to sexually assault their classmates. And I got him on the phone and just, you know, kind of went in on him for like an hour. And he just really didn't even understand that what he was describing was sexual assault. And he wasn't young. This is like, you know, 10 years ago.
He saw it as something like playful interactions between boys and girls.
Yeah, and I had to let him know what it was like going to public pools, like growing up in Detroit, you know, being at Chandler Park or Belle Isle, and, you know, what was considered playful and what was absolutely sexual assault, you know? And so, you know, we had that conversation, and that, I'm not saying that Too Short is some changed man or that calling him in was better than calling him out. I published that article, so it was a call in and call out at the same time. I, too, have been, you know, there's a whole new generation that calls things abuse that I didn't consider abuse before. And I have been called out in that way. I haven't been called in. With this generation, you learn about it when people post about it. They don't like come to you directly. They're like conflict averse, and then they blow up on the internet. But even that model of never having someone come to you with their problems about you has still been instructive to me. I've still been able to learn things. Once you get past the ego bruising of being called out, then you have to look at the charges and then separate things that you can't own to things that you can, and then work on them. And I wish more people were interested in that. You know, it's hard work, though.
To that end, you know, you've mentioned Picasso a couple times, and I'm just curious, when you look at a Picasso, do you see something horrendous or something beautiful or maybe something far more nuanced than that?
Yeah, both. I mean, again, I'm from Detroit, and, you know, like Berlin, this is what one would call like a masculine city. It's not beautiful. It's not Paris. It's not, you know, it's not even San Francisco. Like, it's not even Chicago with its incredible architecture. You know, Detroit is rough looking, but I've always found beauty in it. So when I look at Picasso, I see a lot of things. I see the African art that was influencing him that largely went unsighted by critics and by himself, even though he talked about it to a bit. But more than that, I see him rearranging these women who we know that he just, you know, abused, at least psychologically. He took, like, great glee in it, like a Scorpio would. But I don't know why I'm talking about Picasso. I'm not some Picasso expert, and I don't know everything there is to know about Picasso. But I know that when we hold out particular people as examples of, like, terrible behavior, I just try to remind folks that the people that we hold up as the height of, you know, artistic accomplishment are also going to present these kinds of problems.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking now with Dream Hampton. She's a Detroit native, a filmmaker, an art and culture critic, a woman of many hats, I would say. So let's talk a little bit about then Detroit Narrative Agency, the idea of disrupting harmful narratives about Detroit, a community of filmmakers doing this. What are the most harmful narratives that you'd like to eradicate as a filmmaker?
I think that some of them sound benign, you know. My work isn't necessarily completely focused in Detroit. Of course, Treasure was a documentary that I did about Shelley Hilliard. But the work of Detroit Narrative Agency was thinking about things that, again, seemingly benign as Detroit is back, you know, which is why you see people wearing T-shirts that said Detroit never left. Because implicit in all of those conversations, like everything with Detroit, is this weird race, you know, this narrative that now that white people are moving back to the city, it's somehow back, that everything in between was this dead space. And Detroit in the 80s, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. It was incredibly vibrant. I felt powerful. I remember moving to New York in 1990 and bemoaning the lack of, like, Black civic leadership. I remember David Dinkins in my second year in New York was up for mayor, and everyone was so excited that they were getting to vote for the very first time in New York's history for a Black mayor. And I'm like, what? Like, that's all we have in Detroit, until, of course, we didn't. And so, you know, I remember feeling quite empowered growing up in Detroit. And in the absence of, like, you know, being in an all-Black city meant that in the absence of that kind of racial discord, I mean, you can find some racial discord, you just had to go to the suburbs to do it. We had to deal with stuff like class, you know, like, again, when I say I'm from the East Side, that means something. It means that I'm from, like, the poorest neighborhood, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. And when I went to Cass Tech, all of a sudden I was in school with people whose parents were lawyers and doctors or engineers at Chrysler. And then I just realized, you know, something that, you know, Americans never want to deal with, which is like a class conversation. And so, I don't know, that's one thing about Detroit. Detroit is back, has implicit in it, and DNA, you know, knows this and identifies it and talks about it in their work when they do presentations as a collective of their films. And their films don't necessarily deal with issues like gentrification, but the need to create a Detroit narrative agency was to push back against Detroit as a blank slate, Detroit as a city where other people needed to drop in, whether it was someone from Time magazine or the filmmakers who made that wonderful film, Jesus Camp, and then came to Detroit and made a not-so-great film. You know, just the whole kind of, like, parachute in because, there's no one there to tell their own stories, which was never true. We've always been a city of storytellers and artists.
There's been, especially I think in the past few years, a real push to make sure that Detroiters and Black Detroiters specifically are the artists that are leading the way in telling the narrative of the city, rather than, as you say, somebody hijacking that narrative. Do you think that that the move to ensure that Detroit's artists are at the forefront is a successful one?
I hope that it is. And I know that there are curators, you know, I think of Jova at MOCAD, who are working to make it so, who are making sure that, you know, there are shows up with people like Sterling Tulls or Brie Gant, you know, just to put those local artists, you know, to the fore. We also have always been an international city, you know, as provincial as we seem sometimes. I mean, we know that, you know, techno happened because there was a conversation between, you know, people who are making music here and people who are making music in Germany. So, like, we are always, you know, looking out into the world and you know, doing it through our own lens. But DNA has a show right now at MOCAD. I think about Vanessa Reynolds' work and different people who are local, who are really leading the way in a really organic way.
Right. So you're in the city of Detroit now, and as you've mentioned, you have spent the past few years splitting your time between various cities, including Los Angeles, and I'm sure New York in there as well, if not other cities to do your film projects. What keeps you coming back to the city of Detroit?
Well, I made a real decision to come home in about 07, 08. My daughter was about to be an age where she would, if we were living in Detroit or the Midwest, be learning how to drive. And we weren't. We were living in New York, where people at 50 years old don't know how to drive. So I remember thinking something as random as that, like, I really want my kid to have a Midwestern, you know, kind of teenage years. They can get super fast in New York. And so I made a decision to come home. Family stuff also brought me home. And I guess that's the bottom line. This is my home. And so when I think about the kind of childhood that I want to give my daughter, when I think about having to be close to family, you know, which isn't always, a lot of us, you know, particularly artists, you flee your hometown and your family, you know, they don't understand you and this place is too small for me. but then it's like, you know, it's like the White Stripes' little room, you know, you're like, you're sitting there, you're dealing with whatever amount of success that you have, and you're like, wait, how do I get back to that thing that made me fresh or that made me me? And for me, that's Detroit. And so I'll always come home to Detroit. You know, I won a Kresge grant a couple years, and with that money, I was able to buy something here, which at the time I thought was like the best way to use that money. And I'm so happy that I did, because now I'm priced out of so much of Detroit. And that is a tragedy, too.
Do you still think that the city, I mean, getting back to what makes you fresh, right? Do you think the city influences you and your art still in everything you do?
Well, for sure. I'm definitely not conflict averse. Some millennials and Gen Ys. They're not conflict averse. They just turn up in a different way, like not in your face. And so that, you know, so going to New York and like, say, taking on Dr. Dre at 20 was something that, of course, that's what you do. You know what I mean? This is Detroit, you know? So for me, growing up on the East Side very early on, I just had to learn to fight. For what was right. I can remember the boys around the corner stealing my brother's bike and having to march around the corner and get it back from them. I can remember, like, you know, skate land and like the girls like protecting one another, also fighting one another. Like, I can, so all of these things shaped who I am. I don't always need to be fighting and scrappy in the world. I also learned how to live really well here. It was a really beautiful day yesterday, and I went to my favorite park in the whole world. I really like Hyde Park in London. There are a couple of places that I really love their parks. Mexico City has an incredible park. But Belle Isle is definitely the best park in the world to me. And that's like really good living to me, like to be able to spend a day driving 8 miles around an hour around the island of Belle Isle.
Dream Hampton is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and the newest member of the board of MOCAD. Dream, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.